Okay, good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is religious and intellectual developments in interwar American Judaism. So in other words, what was happening at the elite level between 1920 and 1940 in American Judaism when it comes to religious institutions and schools and of higher education and intellectual life more generally. I want to go through the various religious denominations and then also the non-denominational aspects of Jewish learning, which come to the fore in the interwar period and remain an important part of American Jewish life until this very day. So let's start, you know, all the way to the left with the Reform. Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati was the only place to ordain Reform rabbis in the United States in the early part of the 20th century. And Cincinnati, its problem was that it was a little bit out of the way. You know, it was fine to be for the Reform Seminary to be in a Midwestern city when the vast bulk of American Jewry, at least German American Jewry, lived in the Midwest. But with changing demographics, they were kind of an out of the way place. They also were hewing to the classical Reform doctrines of the late 1800s, of the Pittsburgh Platform. In other words, a very limited connection to rabbinic Judaism, anti-Talmud, anti-Zionist, anti-Hebrew, very much assimilationist and acculturationist, with a belief in God, at least a firm belief in a personal deity, but far removed from the religious traditions of the Jews of Eastern Europe, and a very watered-down kind of Judaism. This was classical Reform, and certain people wanted it to stay that way, but others did not. They wanted a neo-Reform, and the neo-Reform would be pro-Hebrew, pro-Eretz Yisrael, more favorably disposed towards ritual, but not necessarily towards halakhic observance, just the doing of rituals, and a focus on Jewish peoplehood as though the Klal Yisrael is a transnational group, that it really is one group, as opposed to the classical Reform doctrine, which said that Jews are just members of the Mosaic faith, but otherwise are Americans or Germans or Frenchmen or Englishmen. So there is a fissure in the Reform camp. Those who favored the classical theory were their dominant force in Cincinnati. Kaufman Kohler was the president of the seminary until 1921, and then he's replaced by Julian Morgenstern, who would run the show from 1921 until 1948. Those who wanted a more open style of Reform Judaism or liberal Judaism, the neo-Reform, as it were, came to dominate the movement such that by 1937, the Columbus Platform, which we discussed a few years ago in great depth, we had a whole session on the Columbus Platform, that came to replace the Pittsburgh Platform of 1885 and was, again, favorable to Zionism, to Hebrew, to Jewish peoplehood. So where were these kinds of folks going to get their education? The answer is the Jewish Institute of Religion, J-I-R. Today, you may be familiar with the fact that HUC, Hebrew Union College, and J-I-R are one school. It's now known as HUC hyphen J-I-R. Well, that happened in 1950, a year after Stephen Wise died. Stephen Wise was the founder of J-I-R in 1922. Well, who was Stephen Wise? He was a Reform rabbi. His grandfather had been a big rav in Hungary. And his father had been a big rav also, but who went the Reform route, Aaron Wise. And Stephen had an elite education from Columbia University and was privately ordained by the machers of the Reform rabbinate and had a career in the rabbinate, first in Oregon and then in New York. But he almost became the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel. And what happened was he couldn't get the job. Why didn't he get the job? Because he spoke too freely from the pulpit and the lay leadership of Emmanuel didn't like what he had to say. He spoke about the Jewish Jesus, of all things. And Stephen Wise then decided to establish the Free Synagogue, which is today known as the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue. Now, when I say it's free, it doesn't mean there's no dues. No, there's dues. The lay people have to pay. It's the rabbi who's free. He's free in the pulpit to say whatever he wants. There's no prior restraint. and that there's a spirit of free inquiry in all the intellectual endeavors in that synagogue and in that concept of Judaism. So Wise decided in 1922 to establish an alternative liberal seminary, which would not be explicitly identified with Reform, or for that matter, conservative or Orthodox or anything. It would be non-denominational or trans-denominational with a spirit of free inquiry, in which the Jewish studies would be taught as it was in the other seminaries, but there'd be some noticeable difference. One, the classes were given in modern Hebrew, something that which was not the case in HUC, for sure not, and was also not the case in JTS. So the classes were given in modern Hebrew, and there was an emphasis on the practical rabbinate, so issues in the practical rabbinate. Also, Wise wanted men of action, people who were going to be big on the Jewish communal scene, not just quiet congregational rabbis not rocking the boat. He wanted activists, just like he was an activist. One of the things that he did was to have visiting professors who came from Europe, big names. So prestigious intellectuals taught, at least for a time, at JR in New York. Where was it located? It was located on West 68th Street in or right next to Stephen Wise's synagogue, the Free Synagogue. The rich German Jewish elite, and not just German Jewish, but the rich Jewish elite shied away from JIR. It always had money problems because it was too progressive. You know, the stodgy conservative curmudgeon types did not want to give money to JIR. Ultimately, the school would have folded, except that around the time of Wise's death, they agreed to merge with HUC. And so now there's a New York campus and a Cincinnati campus and a Jerusalem campus, and it's one big happy school. But there was a time when they represented two very different approaches towards liberal Judaism, the one being the classical Reform, the other being the neo-Reform, or rather just an open tent liberal Judaism. Okay, well, that takes care of the Reform. Now let's go to the Orthodox. What's the state of affairs, intellectually speaking, in the Orthodox world in the interwar period? Well, the big thing, the big thing, is the establishment of Yeshiva College. So Bernard Revel had, upon his arrival in New York in 1915, done great things to establish the Talmudical Academy, the high school, which is today MTA, and the Teachers Institute from Mizrahi was established in connection with Rietz. So Rietz was expanding its horizons. And in 1923, Revel, together with some of his leading lay leaders and supporters like Nathan Lamport and Samuel Levy and Otto Rosalsky, Mengel Gottesman, all the names of the buildings at YU that if you remember from your student days are the rich guys from the 1920s who helped Bernard Revel build Yeshiva College. So they wanted to come up with $5 million to build a college. Remember, the yeshiva is still on the Lower East Side, and it's just a yeshiva and a high school at that point. They want to build a secular college, and they want to put it uptown in a more dignified middle-class neighborhood of Washington Heights. And in 1926, they buy property in Washington Heights. This is an indication of the Americanization of Orthodoxy, the fact that they moved to a middle-class neighborhood and were not in the ethnic ghetto, all right? But why in the early 1920s is there a desire to create a college? So several factors are in play. One is that Orthodox boys now have a high school diploma because of Talmudical Academy. And once you have a high school diploma, college is the next thing on your horizon. Well, it would be nice to have college under a theologically suitable and culturally suitable environment and not have to go off into the yonder among the heathens. Also, the Ivy Leagues started instituting very severe quotas between 1919 and 1921. After World War I, significant quotas at Harvard and Columbia, which did not exist previously, were imposed, and so it wasn't easy to get into the better schools. So let's make a college, a Jewish college, under Orthodox auspices. We're going to call it Yeshiva College. The classes began in the fall of 1928, uptown. There was an emphasis on the physical beauty of the structure. It looked nice, at least, you know, 90 years ago, the building looked nice. I lived in it, you know, for a few years in the late 90s, early 2000s. By then, it was run down. But in its beginnings, it was a very pretty building, Moorish style, and it was huge, and it was in a nice neighborhood. By the time I was there, it wasn't such a nice neighborhood, but all right, so be it. You know, times change, neighborhoods change. And this was a show that orthodoxy is not just the lower class, you know, economic rung of the ladder, but rather that people were a little higher up and they could appreciate the aesthetics of the thing. Okay. City College at that time was 85% Jewish. It was known as the Cheder on the Hill, on 137th Street. And you could argue that the Jews didn't need their own college attached to the yeshiva. They had City College and they could go to NYU. There were other places in New York that were available to a bacher who wanted to learn Torah but also get a college education. All right, but nonetheless, the folks at Reitz felt very, very strongly that it would be better, more convenient, and better for the yeshiva boys to not have to venture to the outside world. When the school was established, there were those who opposed the creation of the school. Who opposed the creation of Yeshiva College? So a variety of groups. One, the radicals, meaning the communists, the socialists, the Jewish left. Why did the Jewish left oppose the establishment of Yeshiva College? For a few reasons. One, they didn't want to see American Orthodox Judaism take off and thrive. They wanted to see Orthodoxy die, that it's an old world phenomenon that has no place in America. That's what the radicals would have had you believe. But also, from the economic point of view, they thought that $5 million was a colossal waste of money. You know, it's one thing if you can make a little college on the cheap, but $5 million, that's a lot of money to be spending on an Orthodox college. And so the socialists and communist types, the Arbiter Ring types, the, you know, Workman's Circle, they thought this was silly. This was stupid. Okay, who else was opposed to Yeshiva College? The more traditional Orthodox, meaning the Torah Vadas crowd in Brooklyn. So Torah Vadas, which was in Williamsburg at the time, established a high school as well. TA was not the only Jewish high school accredited high school. However, whereas TA was supposed to be a good high school that offered electives and extracurriculars and all sorts of nice things that you would want out of a middle-class high school, Torah Vadas was whatever the state requires, we'll do. Whatever the state doesn't require, we won't do. No, it's bare minimum, bare minimum, which is something that is still around today in the Orthodox world. It's bare minimum secular education and sometimes even less than the bare minimum. Okay. So the Torah Vadas crowd and the Agudas HaRabbanim, of which Bernard Revel was a member and a prominent member at that, many of them felt that an Orthodox rabbi does not need a college education. It was felt that an Orthodox rabbi only needs to know the halacha to paskin the shilas and to give a drasha in Yiddish and genug, that's enough. He doesn't need to know Latin and Greek and math and calculus and all sorts of things. What's the point? He doesn't need to use it, so he doesn't need to learn it. By contrast, the more moderate Orthodox, including the student body at Reitz, who wanted a more well-rounded education, they believed that an American Orthodox rabbi needed to know more than just Torah and Talmud and Shulchan Aruch, but rather had to be able to give a fluent sermon in English and be able to converse with the laity on a wide range of topics of interest to them. Because if the rabbi can't converse in secular topics with his congregants, the congregants are going to think that the rabbi is an amaretz, not in Torah, but in everything else. And that's not good for the dignity and the honor of the office. So you had a legitimate machlokis about these sorts of things. There's a question in the chat. Wasn't Torah Vadas founded as a Mizrahi school in the model of Rabbi Rinus? So you're bringing up an interesting point. Torah Vadas did begin essentially as a modern Orthodox school. And the name indicates Vadas, that it wasn't just essentially a parochial Haredi style school. However, as time went on, Torah Vadas was increasingly parochial, as Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz was not a close-minded individual, but he was closer aligned with the Agudas Rabbanim and eventually Agudas Yisroel, which would be established in the 20s and 30s in the United States, and the school be steered away from the Rabbi Rinus model. So Torah Vadas was not always so pleased when its graduates would then go on to Yeshiva College, as was the case with Norman Lamb and many of his classmates from high school class of 1945. Those are the rabbis who were born in 1927, graduated Torah Vadas in 1945, and were Yeshiva College class of 1949. There was a bunch of really famous ones from that group, including Saul Roth and Norman Lamb. But that's a little bit later on. So who else opposed the creation of Yeshiva College? The answer is some of the wealthy elite of the American Jewish committee crowd, the our crowd, the German Jewish wealthy people, because, first of all, none of them were Orthodox. They were all Reform. But it wasn't just that they were Reform that they opposed an Orthodox school. After all, I could be Reform and say, all right, but that you're Orthodox, that you have your own institution. No, but Louis Marshall was of the viewpoint that American Jews should not create separatist institutions. He did not like the idea of a Jewish vote, for example, as we spoke about last time, that there is no Jewish vote. He would deny it. Jews vote like everybody else without parochial interests. And so too, when it comes to education, Jews will send their kids to Columbia, to Harvard, to NYU, to CCNY, wherever they're going to go to the American colleges. And we don't need to create a separate college just for Jews. He did not like separatism. And there's something to be said for that attitude, that perspective, that in a time when Jews are trying to integrate into society, to have a major issue like higher education be something where Jews are separate and apart might not be the best thing for our community. Okay. Some people defended the creation of Yeshiva College, even those outside the Orthodox orbit, by saying, well, listen, the other religious denominations in America established these universities in a bygone era. You know, all the Ivy League schools were founded with some denominational Christian connection that may have waned with time, but no. Every school, the good schools in the old days, were not public institutions, but rather were private institutions associated with the church. So let the Jews also have one. Let the Jews also have one. And if it be under Orthodox auspices, so be it. Now, that was assuming that the Jews, or namely Bernard Revel and his backers, were creating an Orthodox version of Harvard. But in fact, they were not. What was the issue? It was not an Orthodox Harvard. It was really just a convenience factor for the Bachrim in the yeshiva to be able to study Talmud in the morning and not have to take the subway to 137th Street in the afternoon, but rather stay at 185th Street or 187th Street. You'll have your Torah in the morning and your secular studies in the afternoon, which meant, by the way, that who was the student population? The student population were Jews only, and traditional Jews only. Had it been a Jewish Harvard, then the student population would have been mixed, Jews and Gentiles, like some of the YU graduate schools eventually became, whether Einstein or Cardozo or the Furkow for Wurzweiler. YU has graduate schools that are a mixed bag when it comes to the population, but the undergraduate college never was that way. People might have thought it was going to become that, but it never did. It never became like Brandeis under Jewish auspices, but with a mixed population. It was always just for Jews interested in studying Torah and also going to college. Okay. Who else was important in the interwar period in the Orthodox rabbinate and in Orthodox institution building? So I mentioned the Agudas HaRabbanim, which was founded in 1902 and was the old Eastern European style rabbis in America. And in the interwar period, they were competing with the graduates of Reitz, the members of the Reitz Rabbinical Alumni, which would eventually become the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, in 1935. Norman is asking about that. Wasn't that a function of federal funding? So that you're right about the federal funding affected YU in the 1970s when Reitz had to become a breakaway institution from the broader YU. Over issues of discrimination, gender-related and sexual preference and all that sort of stuff, where Reitz had to become an affiliate of the university, but not the university proper. In order for the university proper to maintain its funding, it could not violate the various title laws and the federal education laws. Okay, so the Agudas HaRabbanim was a strong organization in the interwar period, and they restricted their membership to those who had Yadin Yadin Smicha, the higher level ordination, to serve on a Beis Din, to be a Dayan, a judge. And you had to be a musmach, a graduate of one of the Eastern European yeshivas, or be given smicha by a big gadol, a big great sage. But that the Ritz boys were not welcome. In the communities around the country, this was an ongoing problem of who's going to be the rav of the town. Is it going to be the American, English-speaking rabbi who was ordained by Bernard Revel? Or by Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the big Rosh Yeshiva at the time, Rabbi Moshe Palachik, the Maitre Eloy, who was other big Rosh Yeshiva, or is the Rav of the town going to be the older Rav who came from Europe? So this is something which is a struggle in a lot of neighborhoods. It becomes a struggle in the synagogues, and it becomes a struggle over kashrut supervision as well, because a lot of the Agudas Rabbanim fellows, they made their parnasa, their livelihood, over kashrut supervision. Okay, but the other thing that becomes, comes on the scene is Agudas Yisroel. Agudas Yisroel is founded in 1912 in Europe and has its Knessia Gedola in 1923 in Vienna, where all the heavy hitters of the Eastern European rabbinate show up. Agudas Yisroel in America really didn't get off the ground right away. They claim they were founded in 1922, but really that was as a youth organization, as a Pirchei group, or the Tzeirim, as the youngsters. Real Agudas Yisrael in America doesn't really date before 1939. Why was there this delay? Well, in large measure because many of the Agudas Rabbanim rabbis were Mizrachiniks. They were Zionist. And Agudas Yisrael was non or anti-Zionist. So because of ideological reasons and the absence of Aguda-style Jews in this country, the organization had a late start in America. One of the curious things about American Orthodoxy in the 1920s and 30s was the Malachim. I might have mentioned this a few years ago when we discussed denominational history. Who was the Malach? So the Malach was Rabbi Chaim Avraham Dov Ber Levin. And what was his claim to fame? Well, he came to New York in 1923. He was the tutor for the sixth Rebbe, Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Friedeker Rebbe. Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, and he was the tutor of the sixth Rebbe, but he was a Chabadnik who broke away from Lubavitch, and he was his own Rebbe basically, and he had a shul in the Bronx, and Shraga Feiva Mendelowitz from Torah Vedas used to bring boys to see the Malach. Because many of the boys in Torah Vedas came from families that weren't so frum, but they sent the kids to the school, whatever. You send a kid to a school. It's a common thing in America for families that are not so frum to send a kid to day school. So Mendelowitz wanted these kids to have an influence, from someone who was a real holy roller. So he would take the kids to the Bronx and they would see the Malach. And they started dressing like Charedim, with the tzitzis down to the floor, and they would grow beards and payas and wear jackets and hats. And this was really very foreign to the experience of most of the students of Torah Vedas in the 1920s and 30s. And so Torah Vedas actually tried to expel these kids for being too much of extremists. And in the end, they started their own yeshiva, Nesivas Olam. The Malach himself died in 1938, but his chassidus continued in the Bronx, and then later up in Muncie and in Brooklyn. They veered away from Chabad because they didn't recognize the sixth and seventh Rebbes. They only recognized the first five Rebbes. And because they were extremely anti-Zionist, they gravitated towards Satmar. So there's this curiosity called the Malachim, the angels, from the original Malach, who was a rabbi in the Bronx in the 20s and 30s. Someone once, a Satmar woman, once went to Rabbi Yoel in the late 40s, early 50s, and said, "I'm concerned that my boy is hanging around with the Malachim." And so Rabbi Yoel supposedly said, "Don't worry, he won't fly away." Okay, so enough with the Orthodox world. Let's now go to conservative Judaism. So what's the state of affairs of JTS? JTS in the interwar period was the era of Cyrus Adler. Cyrus Adler. Who was Cyrus Adler? He was American-born. Born in 1863, had a doctorate in Semitics from Johns Hopkins. It was the first ever doctorate in Semitics given in the United States. And He worked for the Smithsonian as the librarian, and then he became an all-around go-to guy among the our crowd because he was a learned individual and a traditional Jew, an Orthodox, a traditional Jew, observant Jew, and he was the company man for all the alphabet soup organizations. So he was on the American Jewish Committee. He was the president of Drop C College. He was the president of the Jewish Community of Philadelphia. He was on the board of JTS. And then when Solomon Schechter died in 1915, Cyrus Adler was made the acting president of JTS. Why? So Schechter was a big scholar, a rabbi, and a scholar of Jewish studies. Why would they take... Why would they take a guy like Adler, who was not a rabbi, not a scholar of Jewish studies, to be the acting president? The answer is because there were three candidates on the faculty: Louis Ginsberg, Israel Friedlander, and Mordechai Kaplan, and none of them were acceptable. Louis Ginsberg was the most brilliant scholar of Judaica in his era. Other than Saul Lieberman, probably he was the number one in the 20th century. And his problem was, he was so smart, and he knew he was so smart, and he couldn't speak to the lay people without being condescending. He couldn't communicate with the Hamonam, the masses, and he had disdain for the irreligiosity of the average American Jew. So you couldn't make him the president of the school, because the president of the school is basically a propagandist for the school, not just an academic officer. Israel Friedlander would have been a good choice. He was a people person. Ultimately, he died for being a people person. He was killed on a humanitarian mission to the Ukraine after World War I. But in 1915, he was not chosen because he was pro-German. It was the middle of World War I, he was pro-German. Mordechai Kaplan wasn't chosen because you could figure it out why. The guy's an apikoros, and everybody was figuring that out. So you can't make a heretic the president of the school if you want to maintain the allegiance of the traditional Jews who border on orthodoxy. Okay. So Adler was the default choice, and some people held him in low regard, Dafka, because he was not a rabbi and a Jewish scholar. But what did he have to deal with during his tenure? What kind of student population was going to JTS to become middle-of-the-road traditional rabbis? So Adler said the following. There are two kinds of groups of students in our school. One group has an intimate acquaintance with Jewish literature, is composed of men who have been brought up in yeshivas abroad, who have hastily acquired a college degree, who may be excellent Talmudists, not very good biblical scholars, and entirely unsuspicious of such things as Hebrew grammar. So, in other words, a guy knows Gemara, knows about a half a Chumash, but knows Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and couldn't tell Hebrew grammar if it fell on him. That's one style of student. The other group is born in America, bred here, has a good all-around training in secular knowledge, practically no Talmud, some Bible, and a good knowledge of Hebrew grammar and a fair knowledge of Jewish history. So basically, the latter group are American-born. They know math, they know science, they know history, they know poli-sci, they got a college degree from a good school, but they basically are amoratsim when it comes to Talmud. They know a little bit of Bible, they know some Jewish history because it's roughly a secular subject, but they don't know the Gemara. And so to make them into rabbis is no simple task. You have to drill them in the head for 5 years to teach them to know a sufficient amount of Talmud to be functioning rabbis. Those were the two different, very different types of students in the same school in the 20s and 30s. One of the things that was the biggest deal in Adler's time was the proposed merger between REITs and JTS. So this is a topic that many have covered in the past, and I spoke about it when we discussed Bernard Revel's career a number of years ago. So there was an attempted merger in the 1920s between JTS and REITs. The reason was because the money people, the lay leadership, they did not understand the differences between the yeshiva and the seminary. They thought it's all traditional Judaism, so we're wasting money by funding two different schools. Let's combine them, save on a bunch of salaries, and we'll have one big institution which will teach traditional Judaism and ordain rabbis. And you have Reform and you have traditional. That's what they didn't think of three different streams. They thought of two, Reform and traditional. But this did not come to pass, and for a variety of reasons. Number one, And the lay people thought the reason why the merger failed was that the academic officers were full of hubris and had big egos and didn't want to give up their titles. And there's an element of truth to that, but that's not the primary reason. Basically, there was a big difference between the yeshiva and the seminary. The yeshiva, as Bernard Revel saw it, was Torah lishma, Torah for its own sake, the classic notion of studying Torah because it's God's will that we should study Torah. Only secondarily is there the ordaining of rabbis because the community needs clergymen, whereas the seminary is primarily about producing rabbis for the community. And also, together with producing rabbis, teaching academic Jewish scholarship, but not Torah lishma. So because the hashkafa, the philosophy is very different, there was no way you could have a merger. And certainly Revel didn't want the merger. Another factor was, well, who's going to teach? You have redundancies in the faculty. Who's going to get fired? That's always a problem. And also you have Mordechai Kaplan. Kaplan is a big player at the seminary, but the Orthodox think that he's a shegetz because he doesn't believe in God. So all these factors militated against ultimately making the schools into one. There would be another attempted merger in the 40s, and also that would come to nothing. One of the things that JTS did in response to talk of a merger was to start ordaining rabbis with real smicha. That in the history of modern era seminaries, so I'm talking about Breslau, Berlin, Vienna, Budapest, all the modern seminaries that existed from the 1850s and onward, including Cincinnati and JTS of New York, none of them gave hatarat hora'ah, classical smicha to decide matters of halakha, hatarat hora'ah. What did they give instead? A diploma that hereby says you're a rabbi, whatever that means. A rabbi, teacher, preacher in Israel. Ravu manhig. These were the various other titles, but they were not the classic smicha. So JTS decided, well, if the Orthodox are going to lambast us for not producing real rabbis, well, guess what? We can produce real rabbis. So in 1918, they gave their first ever Hatarat Hora'ah. Who gave it? Louis Ginzburg gave it to Louis Finkelstein, because Finkelstein was a big goon, a big scholar. But as it turned out, in the history of JTS, I think maybe four people ever got Hatarat Hora'ah. It was Finkelstein, I believe Boaz Cohen, Isaac Klein, and maybe one more that I'm not remembering. On the whole, this didn't take off. Seminary ordination continued to just be seminary ordination, not the classical smicha, which meant that if you got seminary ordination and you wanted to be recognized as an Orthodox rabbi in Orthodox institutions, you had to get a private smicha from some other, you know, big rav or one of the big rabbonim. And I know plenty of people who in mid-20th century were graduates of JTS who did just that, who made it their business to be ordained by a traditional source aside from the JTS diploma. Okay. One of the major figures at JTS in this era was Moses Chaimson. Moses Chaimson was a rigorously Orthodox rabbi. He was the rabbi of Or HaChaim on 95th Street, Lexington Avenue. And he was also a dayan. And there was talk of making him the academic head of the seminary, or the president or something of that sort. And he said, I can't take that job. Why? Because the seminary, although it's traditional, allows its graduates to take pulpits where there's no mechitza, where there's mixed seating, where there's microphones, where there's all sorts of departures from tradition that did not necessarily find sanction in JTS itself. But when you go off into the boondocks, we'll let you get away with it. So Hyamson said, listen, I'm a dayan for a quarter century. I can't sign a diploma that says that you're a rabbi if I know you're going to do things that are against what I think is halakhically appropriate. So in the end, he sort of, he recused himself. But it's interesting that you'd have a big Orthodox rabbi in New York City, a Manhattan rabbi, be the professor of codes at JTS. Okay. Cyrus Adler hated Stephen Wise. A lot of people hated Stephen Wise. Stephen Wise was regarded as a bit of an arrogant person, very, very haughty, thought highly of himself. He was a good orator, but he thought a little too highly of himself. Adler didn't like him. Number one, Adler was a traditional Jew, and Stephen Wise was very much not. Although he was a so-called rabbi, he was very reform. And Adler didn't like the fact that here Stephen Wise is making a competing seminary in New York, only 70 blocks or 65 blocks south of JTS, to ordain liberal rabbis. So the JTS monopoly over the ordination of rabbis in New York was being compromised. So there was a lot of ill will between them. Adler was under a lot of pressure to articulate the position of the seminary. People wanted to know in the 20s and 30s, is the seminary orthodox? Is it conservative? What is the seminary? People were confused. They didn't understand. And Adler wanted to clarify the position of the seminary in a way which was ambiguous on the denominational issue, but leaning towards a very traditional definition. So he didn't say we're Orthodox Judaism. He didn't say we're conservative Judaism. He said the JTS represents traditional Judaism, capital T, or historical Judaism, capital H. These were the terms that he preferred to use to skirt the issues that were developing in his time. Adler was getting on in years in the 1930s as the seminary struggled financially during the Depression, and Louis Finkelstein was groomed to take over. And ultimately, on Adler's death in 1940, Louis Finkelstein is elevated from the position of provost to the position of president. And later he would become chancellor when they would change the organization of the institution. Adler was not a rabbi. He was not a Judaic scholar. He was a traditional Jew. And in many ways, his traditionalism in personal observance is what characterized the seminary itself. That the seminary in the 1920s and 30s did not display on its own property departures from tradition, even if its graduates certainly did. Now, one of the last points I want to make about the conservative movement, or the nascent conservative movement in the interwar period, is its attitude towards the halakha. So in 1917, Len has a comment in the chat, why you had an entire department through the 1960s to place rabbis in conservative congregations. Oh, okay, good. So one of the things that Adler had to do in his tenure, and he spent a lot of time doing it, and he complained about it because he lived in Philadelphia and was commuting to New York twice a week. He complained that he's spending so much time on rabbinical placement, finding jobs for the graduates of JTS. And why was that so difficult? Because early in his tenure, what kind of rabbis did American congregations want? Well, the ones that were gravitating towards reform, more radical departures from tradition, wanted reform rabbis. So they would hire graduates of HUC or the European seminaries. The ones who did not go that route, were more traditional, wanted Orthodox rabbanim, people with real smicha. So to be a JTS grad in 1917, 18, 20, 23, 25, it was no simple task to get a pulpit. But by the around 1929, 30, 31, 32, into the Depression, actually, the JTS grads were more accepted. And certainly by the end of Adler's tenure, it was a pretty rugged degree. You could guarantee yourself a position somewhere in America with a JTS diploma. So things evolved over time. Now, by the 1950s and 60s, YU was placing people in conservative shuls because, not necessarily in an official sense, but with a wink and a nod, people who were musmachim of Ritz were going to these places because they needed work, they needed parnasa. And most of the shuls in America were conservative shuls in the 1950s. So there was no two ways about it. Okay. Now, let's, I got sidetracked for a second. Okay, let's now talk about academic Jewish studies having no bearing on, well, actually, before we do that, one last point, Reconstructionist Judaism. So Mordechai Kaplan is the professor of homiletics at the seminary and is the principal of the Teachers Institute of the seminary. And he's a very influential person, very influential, a lot of Talmidim that he raised up over the years. But he was already 53 years old in 1934 and had yet to write any work of significance, let alone his magnum opus. So that's the year that he puts out Judaism as a Civilization, the very, very important book, Judaism as a Civilization. He would go on to write a bunch of other books about Reconstructionist Judaism and his notions of God and Jewish peoplehood, but a lot of them were redundant. You really don't need to read them. It's enough to read Judaism as a Civilization and you're good to go. What is that book? So the first 150 pages is a sociological analysis of American Jewry and the various denominational groupings. And it's great. It's a very accurate analysis. If you want to know what American Judaism was like in 1934, read the first few chapters of Judaism as a Civilization. The last 400 pages are hard to read, for at least for an Orthodox person, because it's all of his mishigasin about Reconstructionist theology. So he was a great sociologist, but in my view, he wasn't a great theologian. So what's the significance of this book? Well, people read it. A lot of people read it, or at least parts of it. In 1976, my professor, Jeffrey Gurak, was a young, still a student at Columbia, but teaching summer school at Bernard Revel Graduate School, which would become his academic home for the next 40 years. And he put Judaism as a Civilization on the reading list, on the syllabus, for a course on American Jewish history. And who was taking summer courses in Revel in 1976? Well, mostly Rietz guys, you know, guys who were getting smicha, who were getting an MA degree in Revel. In other words, people like me, but 30 years earlier. And one of the students in the class goes over to Professor Gurak after class is over and says, "I can't read this. This is apikorsis. You know, I'm a religious Jew, a smicha student that reads. It's usur, it's forbidden to read Kaplan's Heresies. How could you assign this? This is a yeshiva university." So Dr. Gurak said, "Well, listen, I'm not assigning it to teach you theology. I'm assigning it because it's a very important work in the history of American Judaism, that you really can't understand the trajectory of American Jewish life religiously unless you have a flavor for what Kaplan wrote. So, it's assigned as an academic matter, not as a theological matter." So the student supposedly answered, "Fine, I'll read it, but only in the principle of Dam Masha Tashiv L'Apikoros, just so that I know how to respond to the heretics." So that was, Dr. Gurak likes to tell that story. Now, let's go to secular university settings and academic Jewish studies, a topic dear to me and to many people out there. So you could only study Judaic studies in the various seminaries that taught you to become rabbis. There was no chair in academic Jewish studies in any American university in the early part of the 20th century. The first place to offer courses was Columbia. Richard Gottheil offered some courses, but there was no endowed chair. There was no department. And it was not in Talmud, but it was like in Semitics or so maybe Hebrew or a little bit of Bible. There was no chair in Judaic studies. Until Hyman G. Enelow, the rabbi at Emmanuel, who was a big scholar in his own right, more than being just a Reform rabbi, he was a Judaic scholar. He encouraged his wealthy parishioners to donate money to endow chairs in academic Jewish studies in the major universities in America. And he found success in two of his congregants. And as we shall see, there's a New Rochelle connection to both of them that I didn't know about until today. So I'm actually very excited about this New Rochelle connection. So the first one was Harvard. Harry Ostrin Wolfson. Harry Wolfson was a yeshiva boy. He was born near Vilna in 1887, and he went to Slabodka. He went to Yeshiva Knesset Yisrael, where he studied, you know, in the traditional way. But then his family came to America in 1903, and he went to Harvard. He was Harvard class of we have from Saul Newman. My grandfather, Louis Newman, got his PhD from Gottheil, 24 Columbia. Ah, so very good. So Gottheil, you know, was a longtime professor of Semitics at Columbia. His father had been the rabbi of Emmanuel, Gustav Gottheil. But as I said, he was in not the Judaic Studies department, which didn't exist. He was in the Semitics department, in the history department. So what happened was that Hyman Enelow encouraged his people to give money, and Harry Wolfson was studying at Harvard. He got his PhD there in 1915, and he taught some courses, basically wasn't paid for his work. He was self-funded. But then in 1925, somebody comes up with a lot of money to give to Harvard to endow a chair in Jewish history. And who was it? It was Lucius Litauer. Lucius Littauer was born in 1859, dies in 1944, was an Emanuel member, and was a former congressman. He was a congressman from the state of New York from 1897 to 1907, a five-term member of the House of Representatives. He was also the first ever football coach at Harvard. An interesting character. He came from Gloversville, New York. And because he came from Gloversville, what business was he in? Glove making. Okay. But then he went into banking, made a lot of money. And in 1925, endowed a chair at Harvard, named for his father, Nathan Littauer. And then in 1930, donated 12,000 rare books to Harvard. And President Lawrence Lowell of Harvard accepted this gift, which was a controversy at the time, but accepted the gift and endowed the chair. And Harry Wolfson became the first ever professor of Jewish studies at Harvard. But there's an interesting sidelight to Lucius Littauer. In 1914, he was arrested for smuggling and not paying import taxes. And he was sentenced to 6 months suspended sentence by the judge. He didn't actually go to jail, but he was guilty of a crime. And the judge yelled at him and said, how could you violate your five-time oath that you took when you swore as a member of Congress to honor the laws of the federal government, and you were guilty of smuggling $40,000 worth of jewels from Venice. So he had his Shonda moment, Lucius Littauer, but he gave a big gift to Harvard for academic Jewish studies. He died in 1944, in New Rochelle. He owned a house, a summer home on Premium Point. It was the house next to the one that was owned by Joe Torre. So for those who know Premium Point and know where Joe Torre lived, you know, for those us New Rochellians who's been out there, it was the house next door. It was Lucius Littauer's house. Okay, now let's go to Columbia. So Columbia had the chair endowed by Linda Rosenberg Miller. Linda Miller was born in 1877 in West Virginia, died in 1936. She was a member of Emanuel, and Hyman Enelow was her Rebbe, and he encouraged her to make a gift to a university. So her husband, Nathan Miller, had been a successful businessman, but then died, and the business went broke, and there was other tragedies in the family. I think a daughter died. So Linda Miller had a lot of tzaris in her life, but she was interested in charity. Now, whereas most Jewish women with money in the 1920s and 30s were interested in Hadassah and poor relief, you know, poverty, real tzedakah for the aniyim, for the matanos levyonim type of tzedakah, she wasn't interested in that. She was interested in intellectual tzedakah. So she was interested in libraries, funding publications. That was her area of interest. And so she gave $250,000 in 1928 to Columbia. The gift was accepted by President Nicholas Murray Butler, of Butler Library fame, okay? And it was for a chair in Jewish history, literature, and institutions. But the question is, who would be the professor? So they interviewed a few people. They interviewed Jacob Klatskin, and he didn't want the job. They interviewed Ismar Elbogen, and he didn't want the job. He was teaching at JIR. And then they interviewed Salo Whitmire Barone, who took the job. And in 1930, began teaching as the professor of Judaic studies. He would continue until his retirement in 1963 and would die in 1989 at the age of, 94 years old. Salo Barone was an interesting character. He had three PhDs. He went to the University of Vienna and had a PhD in philosophy in 1917, poli-sci 1922, and law 1923, and was ordained as a rabbi from the JTS of Vienna in 1920. He came to America in the early 20s, the mid-20s, to teach at JIR, and was hired by Columbia in 29. His biggest claim to fame outside of, says that Jacob Neusner famously said that the Protestants have to endow chairs in the history of the Reformation. That's true. So his biggest claim to fame outside of the academic world was that Barone testified at the Eichmann trial against Eichmann because he came from Tarno, and Tarno had 20,000 Jews before the war, and after the war was over, it had 20 Jews, and his own family, his parents and his sibling were killed. So he testified in Yerushalayim at the Eichmann trial, and he testified in Hebrew. And I remember I watched the footage, and he apologizes at the very beginning of his testimony, saying in Hebrew, Slachli, forgive me if I struggle with a little bit of words because I'm not a fluent speaker of modern Hebrew. He ended up speaking perfectly fluently, but he wanted to apologize because it wasn't his first language. He actually spoke 10 different languages. Now, Baron, his magnum opus was The Social and Religious History of the Jews, an 18-volume set. Many of you probably have it in your homes on your shelves, but you probably also never open it. It's one of those things that people have, you know, intellectual Jews like to have on the shelf, but they never open it. Encyclopedia Judaica you probably also have on your shelf, but that you probably open every now and then. So Gretz, Heinrich Gretz in the 19th century, believed in the lachrymose conception of Jewish history. That what is Jewish history? Suffering and scholarship. And Baron said, we have to move past the lachrymose conception of Jewish history. That our history is not just suffering and scholarship, but rather there's also periodic joy and ultimate salvation. So, you know, don't think we're just here to be pushed around and to study Talmud. There's more to Judaism than anti-Semitism and Talmud study. What Baron tried to do was to integrate Jewish religious history into a broader narrative about Jewish peoplehood and Jewish social history and political history, economic history, to tie it all together. That religion doesn't stand alone as part of a bigger package. But what he also tried to do was to integrate Jewish history into the history of human civilization. That Jews are not just Amlav Adad Yishkon, a people that dwells alone, but rather we dwell with everybody else. And that we have to understand our interactions with the host societies in every era. So that's why his magnum opus, it's not just the Jewish history divorced from everybody else, but as we participate in the wider world. Okay. Baron, interestingly, although he was ordained as a rabbi, was extremely, extremely secular. One of his big Talmidim was Arthur Hertzberg. Now, Arthur Hertzberg should be known to you as a big conservative rabbi, a professor at Columbia in his own right. Hertzberg wrote many books about American Jewish history and about the French Revolution and Haskalah. So Hertzberg, who was the rabbi in Teaneck, at the conservative shul in Teaneck, he would very often invite Baron to come to services for the high holidays. And Baron always refused. He never went to shul, refused to go to shul. When he died, Hertzberg officiated at the funeral. That was like the only time he had to die for a rabbi to participate in his life. Okay. The various chairs in Columbia and Harvard both like to claim they were the first chair in Jewish studies in America. Which one was the first one? So the truth of the matter is Harvard, the donation was made in 1925 and was completed in 1930. For Columbia, the donation was made in 1928 and the academic program began in 1930. I want to read to you, I printed it out because I thought it was fascinating. What was the course description for the first ever Judaic studies program at Columbia? So this is Baron's course listings. So the one of them is Ancient Jewish History and Literature. This course will embrace a survey of the geographical position of Palestine, its early history and the origin of Israel, the political, economic, and social history in the period of the kings, the exile, the Second Commonwealth, the condition of the Jews under the Hellenistic, Roman, and Persian empires, Old Testament literature and religion, Apocrypha, Hellenistic literature, Jewish sects, the Jewish background of Christianity, the Mishnah, and the Talmud. Now that's a lot to cover in one semester, in one course. But it goes to show you that, you know, he wanted to give the students a feel for as much of Jewish history as possible of the so-called classical era or ancient era, dating from Sefer Malachim or Sefer Yehoshua almost, all the way to the Tanaim and the Amoraim, with everything in between. Then the next course was Medieval and Modern Jewish History and Literature. Truncated together was basically everything from, you know, the Gaonic period through modern times. The next course that he offered was one that I would have been very interested in, Social and Political History of the Jews during the 19th century. So this is, you know, very recent. This is 1930 we're talking about, and they're giving a course about the 19th century. So the previous century. What was the nature of the course? an analysis of the principal social, economic, and political movements and events in the history of the Jews of Europe and America, from the American and French revolutions to the end of the 19th century, population problems and migrations, economic transformations, Jews in modern capitalism, Jews in socialism, the struggle for emancipation, anti-Semitism, assimilation and Jewish nationalism, the origins of Zionism, some international attempts to solve the Jewish question. So this is a fascinating course, covering a lot of topics that in our day would be 10 different courses. But in his time, when he's just first starting out, he's got to lump it all together in one semester. The last one was something that was specific to the things that he liked to discuss, Jewish religious institutions, community and family. This course will treat of the origins, the historical development and present day condition in different countries of Jewish communal organizations, the synagogue and other communal institutions, the history of Jewish marriage and the position of women and children in Jewish law and social life from biblical times to our own day. So you could imagine that like a sort of a beginnings of Jewish gender studies, and you know, the family law, family life, that sort of thing. So who was taking these courses? Was it Jewish students only? No, not necessarily. There were Gentiles who took these kind of courses. But on the whole, who was interested in this stuff? Jews who would themselves go on to either careers in the rabbinate or careers in academic Jewish studies, but there weren't that many jobs to be had. So it was almost like a pyramid scheme in the sense that you're going to get a degree that you can't use very, very, very easily. And people going into Jewish communal life who wanted to have a background in Judaic studies. One of the things that was established around this time was the American Academy of Jewish Research. It was established in 1919. It was a colloquium of professors in the various institutions who could put out a proceedings, have an annual conference and put out a proceedings, a journal of papers on Jewish topics. The various journals that existed at that time were the Hebrew Union College Annual, which began in 1924, and Jewish Social Studies, which began in 1933. There was also Jewish Quarterly Review, JQR, which had been around since the late 1800s and was put out by Drop C College. Drop C College was the only one of these various institutions which was a Jewish institution, but not a denominational one and not for the purpose of ordaining rabbis. Who went to Drop C? Well, for the most part, they were conservative and Orthodox rabbis who wanted to be rabbi doctor. So many of the big scholarly Orthodox rabbis of mid-century had degrees from Drop C that they got in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the first one of which was Bernard Revel himself. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. I'll take any questions. This was an important topic to cover. It may not have been the juiciest, but I think it's important to know higher learning in America, Jewish higher learning, what was it all about? Where was it coming from a parochial perspective and from a university perspective? And today, it's a burgeoning field. You know, every university has a Judaic studies faculty with many courses and many students, but it wasn't always that way. It began in the 1930s in the fashion that I've laid out. And I forgot to mention the New Rochelle connection to Linda Miller, the one who endowed Columbia. She died in New Rochelle and was buried in New Rochelle. So both the founders, Lucius Littauer and Linda Miller, were New Rochellians later in life. Questions?
What about Penn? Wasn't Jastrow there?
Jastrow. So Jastrow died in 1902. Jastrow was at the University of Pennsylvania teaching some classes while he was the rabbi of Rodef Shalom. And of course, he put out his dictionary, which came out actually posthumously, I think. So he was an example where prior to the existence of Jewish studies departments and universities, many of the big universities did allow prominent Jews, clergymen especially, to offer some Jewish related courses. For example, University of Chicago had Emil Hirsch, was the big Macha rabbi, reform rabbi in Chicago. He taught at the University of Chicago Semitics and, you know, allied fields, Jewish-related topics, but was not an endowed chair, and that wasn't how he got his parnassa. The first person to really have a career in the academic field was Harry Wolfson. And with this, I'll close. One of the goals of Leopold Zuns and the founders of Wissenschaft des Judentum in the 19th century was that Jewish studies should enter the canon of Western civilization, okay, like all other branches of Western knowledge, and that you should be able to go to school, get a doctorate, do coursework, do teaching, write a dissertation and write books and become, have a full career at an elite level institution in Jewish studies. So that was impossible in Leopold Zunz's time. He never had that luxury. Harry Wolfson was the first ever person, at least in America, to accomplish that. Bear in mind, it's happening at the same time that Hebrew University is being established in Jerusalem, where, of course, the first faculty was the Faculty of Jewish Studies with Gershom Scholem and the other heavy hitters, Fritz Baer. So it's happening in Palestine simultaneously with it's happening in America. Questions?
Well, the chairs that were endowed during the time of the quotas against Jewish?
Yes.
That's ironic.
Well, you're right, it is. But bear in mind the following. People who are elite WASPs, they might like the idea of a scholar of Jewish philosophy, Jewish history, Talmudics, rabbinics, yet not want a lot of, have a lot of Jews on campus. There's a difference between liking the discipline and disliking a glut of students of a certain ethnic group.
Is that like having Notre Dame having Talmudic scholars on the church side?
The difference being that that's an overtly religious institution, but there's a similarity there. Yes.
So, what were the doctorates in the philosophy or?
So the PhDs could have been in a variety of departments. Jewish studies was, for example, at Columbia, you could get it in the religion department, you could get it in the history department or the philosophy department, depending upon what your area of interest was within Jewish studies. Okay. Anybody else? We're good? Okay, folks.
Thank you.
We continued. Next week, we'll do Jews and the Great Depression. See you next time.
Have a good forum.
Happy forum, everybody.